You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a set of essays by Rudolf Steiner for Introductions to Goethe's Scientific Writings. It's entitled Nature's Open Secret. This is Chapter 6, entitled Goethe's Way of Knowing. Johann Gottlieb Fichte sent Goethe the first section of his titled Theory of Science in June 1794. On June 24th, Goethe replied to the philosopher, quote, "For my part, I will owe you a tremendous debt of gratitude if you finally succeed in reconciling me with philosophers, whom I have never been able to do without, but with whom I have never been able to feel united." Close quote. What the poet was asking of Fichte he had sought earlier from Spinoza, as he would later from Schelling and Hegel, a philosophical worldview that corresponded fully with his own way of thinking. But none of the philosophical approaches he encountered satisfied him completely. This makes our task all the more difficult, for we intend to approach Goethe from a philosophical perspective. If he had claimed a scientific stance, we would refer to it, but this is not the case. Thus our task is to consider all of the poet's work that is available, discern its philosophical center, and sketch its salient features. We maintain that the correct approach to this matter is to follow a line of thought based on German idealistic philosophy, which tried in its way to satisfy the same highest human needs to which Goethe and Schiller devoted their lives. It arose from the same cultural movement, and is therefore much closer to Goethe than the views that generally dominate science today. From this philosophy, we will be able to construct a view from which Goethe's poetic and scientific works can be derived. We would never be able to do this on the basis of contemporary tendencies in science. Today we are very remote from the way of thinking inherent in Goethe's nature. It is indeed true that we have advanced in every area of culture, but it can hardly be maintained that this has also been an advance in depth. In the end, the significance of an era can be measured only by its progress in terms of depth. One is inclined to say, however, that our age is best distinguished by its wholesale rejection of the possibility of any real human deepening. We have become faint-hearted in all areas, especially in our thinking and will. When it comes to thinking, there is an endless accumulation of information, but there is no courage to place it into the context of a comprehensive scientific view of reality. German idealistic philosophy, on the other hand, is accused of being unscientific because it had such courage. Today, people want to perceive with their senses, but not think. All confidence in thinking has been lost. Thought is considered incapable of penetrating into the mysteries of the world and of life. People have resigned themselves completely to living without any solution to the great riddles of existence. The only thing considered possible is to create a system out of what is provided by sensory experience. Footnote: since Steiner's time, this scientific approach has been refined through systems theory and quantum mechanics, and an immense amount of empirical research has been done. There has been no progress in depth, however, because, as Steiner pointed out 100 years ago, the central constitutive role of thinking in creating our insight into reality has not been recognized. Editor, end of footnote. We forget that this perspective leads us to a position believed to have been overcome long ago. When deeply considered, the rejection of all thinking and the exclusive reliance on sensory experience are based on the same kind of blind faith in revelation that we find in religions. Ultimately, such faith rests merely on the fact that we are asked to believe what the churches hand down as ready-made truths. Thinking may strive to penetrate to their deeper meaning, but it lacks the capacity to approach the truth, to penetrate to the depths of the world through its own power. What does a science limited to sense experience require of thinking? That it consider the factual information and then interpret and arrange it. The independent power of thinking to penetrate to the core of the world is denied by this science. Theology, on the one hand, demands blind subjection of one's thinking to the dictates of the Church. Science, on the other, demands blind subjection to the dictates of the senses. In either case, independent, deeply insightful thinking counts for nothing. Empirical science forgets that thousands upon thousands of people may have observed a sense-perceptible fact and passed it by without noticing anything remarkable about it. Then along comes someone who sees it and perceives within it the working of an important law. How do we explain this? The discoverer must have been able to look in a way that was different from those who came before. The discoverer perceived the fact with different eyes, had a certain thought about how to relate that fact to others, about what was significant in it and what was not. In this way, those who make scientific discoveries comprehend and order their experience through thinking, and consequently see more than others do. They see with the eyes of the Spirit. All scientific discoveries stem from the circumstance that the observer is able to observe in a way that is guided by the right thought. It is natural that thinking should guide observation. But it cannot do so when the researcher has lost confidence in it and does not understand its scope and significance. Empirical science helplessly roams the world of phenomena. The world becomes for it a confusing multiplicity of particulars because it lacks the energy of thought to penetrate its experience. People speak of limits of knowledge today because they fail to understand the task of thinking. They lack a clear view of what they wish to achieve and doubt their ability to achieve it. If someone were to come today and show us the solution to the mystery of existence, we would gain nothing from it, because we would not know what to make of it. It is exactly the same with our will and our actions. People are unable to set themselves a definite life task that they can actually accomplish. They merely fantasize about indefinite, vague ideals, and then complain when they fail to achieve what they can barely envision. Just ask today's pessimists about what they really want and what they despair of accomplishing. They have no idea. Their nature is entangled in problems. They cannot cope with any situation, nor are they satisfied with any. Do not misunderstand me. It is not my intention to promote a superficial optimism that remains contented with life's trivial pleasures and yearns for nothing higher. I do not wish to condemn those who are painfully aware of our deeply tragic dependency on conditions that paralyze our every action, which we vainly struggle to change. Let us not forget that pain is the precursor of joy. A mother's joy in her thriving children is that much sweeter when that joy has been won through worry, suffering, and effort. Every thinking person would, in fact, have to refuse any happiness offered by an external agent, because ultimately we cannot experience real happiness as the result of what is handed to us as an unearned gift. A creator who had intended to grant a heritage of happiness to humankind would have done better not to create us in the first place. Human dignity is increased when what we create is always cruelly destroyed. After all, as a result, we must always build and create anew. Our happiness lies in doing and in our accomplishments. Revealed truth is like unearned happiness. Our human dignity depends on our seeking the truth ourselves, guided neither by sensory experience nor by revelation. Footnote: As a student of Goethe, Steiner was keenly aware of the importance of sensory experience, and he strongly defends its validity in the later sections of this work. Here, however, he is making the same point as in the above example of the discovery of a scientific law. Only through our own thinking activity can we approach true reality. Editor. End of footnote. Once this has been thoroughly recognized, revealed religions will have played themselves out. People will no longer look for revelations from God, nor hope for freely bestowed blessings. They will want knowledge gained through their own thinking and happiness created through their own efforts. Whether a higher power directs our destiny toward good or ill is of no concern to us. We ourselves must determine our own paths. The most exalted idea of divinity is still a God who, after creating human beings, withdrew completely from the world and left us entirely to our own devices. Whoever attributes to thinking a perceptive capacity that goes beyond that of the senses must also acknowledge that this capacity directs itself toward objects that lie beyond sense-perceptible reality. The objects of thinking, however, are ideas. When our thinking comprehends an idea, it unites with the foundations of universal existence. That which is actively at work in the outer world enters the human spirit. The human being unites with objective reality in its highest potency. Beholding the idea in outer reality is the true communion of the human being. Thinking relates to ideas as the eye, E-Y-E, relates to light and the ear to sound. It is an organ of perception. This view can bring together two approaches, currently considered completely incompatible: the empirical method and idealism as a scientific worldview. Footnote: Steiner uses idealism in the broad sense, which views ideas as the ultimate reality, as in the German idealism of Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel. This view also includes moral idealism, as implied by the English use of the word. By uniting empirical method with idealism, Goethe's scientific view bridges the gap between the two. Editor. End of footnote. It is generally believed today that the acceptance of the empirical method necessarily leads to the rejection of idealism. This is certainly not true. Of course, this must be our conclusion if we believe the senses are our only organs for perceiving objective reality. The senses provide only those relationships between things that can be reduced to mechanical laws. Footnote. This sentence seems to contradict one of Steiner's main insights. He himself often points out that sensory perception alone does not provide any interrelationships whatsoever. These are established only through thinking. See Chapter 9, Goethe's Theory of Knowledge, pages 93 and 101 farther down in the book. This contradiction is resolved when we consider the following. We gain insight into organic nature to the extent that we apprehend the external particulars as manifestations of an inner lawfulness or idea. We proceed from the whole to the parts. We do this through what Goethe called judgment through intuitive perception. When we observe the particulars in and of themselves, however, this relationship to the idea is lost, and we then resort to explaining their behavior as arising through mechanical cause and effect. We proceed to explain the whole in terms of the interaction of its parts. We do this through our intellect. Parenthesis, see also Steiner's characterization of intellect and reason, pages 110 forward in the book. Close parenthesis. We can now understand the sentence in question to mean, quote, the senses combined with the intellect provide only those relationships between things that can be reduced to mechanical laws. And a close quote from the editor and a footnote. Based on this, the mechanistic worldview would be the only true one. This view, however, makes the error of simply ignoring other equally objective elements of reality that cannot be reduced to mechanical laws. What is objectively given does not in any way coincide with what is given to the senses, as the mechanistic view maintains. What is given to the senses is only half of the given. The other half consists of ideas, which are also objects of experience, admittedly of a higher experience, and accessible to the organ of thinking. Ideas can thus also be attained through the inductive method. Contemporary empirical science follows an entirely correct method. It adheres to the given, but adds the inadmissible stipulation that this method must lead to sense-perceptible, factual results. Rather than limiting itself to the question of how we arrive at our views, it determines from the outset what the nature of these views must be. The only satisfactory scientific approach is an empirical method that leads to ideas as its results. This is idealism, not the kind that pursues a vaguely fantasized universal oneness, but one that attempts to apprehend the concrete idea of reality with the same certainty of experience with which today's extremely exact sciences seek facts. Footnote: Steiner describes Goethe's scientific method more concretely in Chapter 7, page 83, and in Chapter 10, Part 1, editor, end of footnote. By approaching Goethe with these views, we believe that we are penetrating to the very nature of his being. We hold to idealism, but base its development not on the dialectic method of Hegel, but on a higher, more purified empiricism. A similar view also underlies Edward von Hartmann's philosophy. Footnote: Edward von Hartmann, 1842-1906, German philosopher, who synthesized the views of Schopenhauer, Kant, and Hegel into a doctrine of evolutionary history based on conflict between the unconscious will and conscious reason. He is generally considered a pessimist, though he shared Hegel's broader sense of optimism. See also Steiner's discussion of Hartmann in his Autobiography, Chapter 16, Chapter 6 in earlier editions, editor, end of footnote. He searched for the ideal unity in nature as it yields itself in a positive form to a content-filled thinking. He rejected the merely mechanistic view of nature and hyper-Darwinism, which clings to outer appearances. In science, he established a concrete monism. He looked for concrete ideas in history and in aesthetics. In all of this, he followed empirical, inductive methods. Hartmann's philosophy differs from mine only with regard to the question of pessimism and his metaphysical emphasis on the unconscious, which we will consider later. What Hartmann presents as the grounds for pessimism, the view that nothing in the world can fully satisfy, that dissatisfaction always outweighs pleasure, is precisely what I would call our good fortune as human beings. To me, what he offers merely proves that it is useless to pursue happiness. Indeed, we must give up all such efforts and find our life's purpose in selflessly accomplishing the idealistic tasks established by our reason. What else can this mean but that we should seek our happiness only in the unceasing activity of creating? The only people who ever manage to fulfill their destiny in life are those who are active, indeed only those who are magnanimous in their actions, with no desire for reward. It is foolish to desire a reward for our activity. There is no real reward. These are the insights upon which Hartmann ought to build. He should point out that under such circumstances, there is really only one possible motive for our actions. Once the prospect of attaining a desired goal falls away, the motivating force cannot be anything but selfless devotion to the object itself. It can only be love. Only action that arises from love can be moral. In science, our guiding star must be the idea. In our actions, it must be love. And this brings us back to Goethe. Quote, "An active human being is concerned with doing the right thing, not about whether the right thing happens. The art of living involves giving up our existence in order to exist." From Verses in Prose. Close quote. I did not arrive at my worldview only by studying Goethe, or Hegel for that matter. I began with the mechanical, naturalistic worldview. Then I realized that intensive thinking renders such a perspective untenable. Proceeding strictly according to scientific method, I found that objective idealism is the only satisfactory worldview. My title, Theory of Knowledge, shows how thinking, when it comprehends itself and does not contradict itself, arrives at this view. Then I found that this objective idealism, in its fundamental thrust, fully permeates Goethe's worldview. Indeed, for years my own views have developed parallel with my study of Goethe, and I have never found my basic outlook to conflict in principle with Goethe's scientific work. If I have succeeded, at least in part, first in developing my point of view so that it comes to life in others as well, and second in convincing them that this really is Goethe's position, then I consider my task fulfilled. The end of chapter 6.